So welcome to the next episode of the Postcritical Psychogeographies from Weak Resistance to Weak Avant-Garde. I'm super honored and very happy to welcome Stephen Shukaitis, who is a professor at the Essex University in UK. He has been working with Autonomedia, and he's the founder and the editor of Minor Compositions Imprint, as well as he's the host of the very amazing and very interesting Minor Compositions podcast, in which I had the honor to be a guest in the episode about anti-fascism, feminist anti-fascism, and minor anti-fascism, as far as I recall the title was. Stephen is the author of amazing books, The Wages of Dreamwork, Class Composition, Social Reproduction, and Cultural Labor, published last year together and written, I believe, together with Joanna Figel. A friend of mine also, Combination Acts, Notes on Collective Practice in the Undercommons from 2019, Rituals, Epistemology, Imaginary Power, Art and Insurrection, 2019 was Richard Gilman Opalski, The Composition of Movements to Calm Aesthetics and Cultural Labor After the Avant-Garde from 2016, and you are currently, maybe let's just jump in your first, your most recent project, if you want to give one or two sentences about that, and then I'll follow the question lines. So, welcome in the podcast. Welcome in the podcast, Stephen, and I'm honored and delighted to have you. So, or maybe let's continue with the questions, because I believe in the questions there is a big chance for you to advertise your book. So, I'll go with the questions. First, what is your first association with the avant-garde? Do you have a definition of avant-garde, a favorite or least favorite examples of it, if you could tell us?
I'm certainly not going to go with favorite or least favorite, because that's like asking which of your children is their favorite ones. I'll start with something kind of definitional. So you can either think of avant-garde in terms of, let's say, a formal aesthetic sense, so challenging artistic conventions. So you have cubism, fabulous, you have a whole list of them, right? Or you could think of it in terms of the way it usually is measured in political terms as a vanguard. And so for me, the most interesting aspect is when these two things come together, when you have a attempt to create new forms of aesthetics, political expression that are a part of creating a radical politics. So if I would have to choose more favorite forms, it would be times where these come together in interesting ways. So I fall back on things like Russian constructivism, the situationists, the history of free jazz. And I like, so one thing I riffed on in the previous book is The Composition of Movements to Come comes from the title of an album by the band Refused, the Shiva Punk to Come, which takes its title from an Ornette Coleman, the sort of jazz to come, which borrows a melody line from The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky.
Of course.
Particularly in the ways you get these sort of almost like remainders or traces of particular conjunctions of art and politics that get sort of spread, that have their own lineages, they get taken up and reprocessed again and again.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. And when I was reading the titles of your books, I was also fascinated because somehow those titles are rich enough already. I mean, the notions you use and all those concepts are so amazingly important also for what I'm trying to think of within the topic of avant-garde and beyond it. And I really appreciate and I really like this intersection of ethico-political, let's say, and formal. Because for me, it's also the defining elements, like disagreement with the status quo, to put it very largely, very openly, and some formal exercise in reshaping the ways of experiencing the world. I really like this concept from Jacques Rancière, you know, the partition of the sensible, because it's richer than just seeing. It's basically about experience. So the interesting, the politically fruitful, let's say, aesthetic move would be the one that transforms our way of experiencing the world. And I have a very nasty example of Elfriede Jelinek for that, whose books were so impressive, made such an impression on my entire organism, I think, I mean, on my brain specifically, that I would smell, you know, all those odors that she was like despising in her novels. For a week or so, I couldn't travel with a tramway because I was somehow, you know, sensing the the dirt of those bourgeoisie and lower classes traveling with me on the means of public transportation. So it was a very, I would say, a very conservative repercussion of otherwise fantastically leftist Elfriede Jelinek, but that's what happens to me. So I'm kind of, you know, I have this idea that aesthetics can change our ways of experiencing the world. And obviously, not every one of them does it to such a huge extent, but they do, they have the compelling power, I think, to basically transform our experience. And I think your in your next project, you're going to be working on the intersections of counterpublics and aesthetics, right? So I'm curious, like, if you want to give us 2-3 sentences, where you're going with this exercise, like, which era, which strategies are important for you, and why?
One of the things I find interesting is this, like, oftentimes forms of art which are most explicitly political end up being less interesting in their actually stated politics, but more in the organizational practices which underpin them. So, to give you an easy example, I grew up in the 90s in the punk scene. And I think what I took most of that was less sort of like the lyrics or like, you know, actual state content, the music, but more a practice of how do you organize things together? How do you put together a zine? How do you put together a show? How do you run your own record label? So it's sort of a sense of like the production processes that underlies that stuff. And so one of my next projects is going to be looking at if today we're seeing a sort of collapse of the public sphere, what we do, okay, you know, public is not a public sphere. So everything is overwhelmed by immaterial networks of communication. Everything can be constantly put to work, but there is no actual public sphere for engagement and dialogue. I want to look back to a history of artistic activist practices, which could be thought to engender a kind of or help to build a non-state public sphere. So that's the idea. I mean, I haven't gotten. Yeah, I have. That's the next project.
Yeah, I love it that you're doing this, because I think, as far as I remember the description of your next book, you're going into Virno and the counterpublics, no? His like notion of counterpublics. And this was fascinating for me because I come from very much Klugend-necked counterpublics sort of experience, and also from Negri and Hart, who are your basic references, I would say, in knowing not super much of your work, but some of it, I would say this is very central. So I try to bridge, you know, the critical and the post-Spinozan traditions, because I think they've been, you know, fighting too long over the Hegelian versus Spinozan ontology. And I think that they meet precisely in this moment of creating theoretical frameworks for counter whatever, counter publics, counter activism, counter politics, counter gendered experience, etc., etc. So for me, this is fascinating. Also, how with the aesthetics, we can do something that Negri was very fond of, which means creating the theory of social movement with social movement, not, you know, from the desk, but sort of building it as it happens, learning from its experience. And I think that for me, writing about art and also collaborating with artists and participating in artistic projects, and also, you know, I grew up in the 90s, but in Warsaw, so not in Pennsylvania, as I think you did, but in Warsaw. And in Warsaw, what we were doing psychogeography. We were actually trying to reframe, recontextualize, and repeat to some extent the experience from situationists, the experience from squatters, all kinds of social movements. And in these repetitions, it was an embodied experience. We had to go in the cities. We had to pick the locations. We had to block some streets if necessary. This was usually, you know, in order to, I don't know, to promote bikers' paths over car paths, car highways, and, you know, this kind of things. But this was a very important experience for me. And then working with artists, I realized it's pretty much the same things. It's trying to find new ways of inhabiting the world. So I'm curious about the avant-garde also as like experience, you know, the kind of ways of experience that the avant-garde offers because of this negation of the status quo and because of this search of novelty. I don't think it's solely conceptual work. I think it's very much about embodiment and how we live in this world. So, how is your own work invested with the avant-garde? You spoke about it a little bit, but I think that we can dwell into it. Like, where do you find, you know, inspiration other than, you mentioned jazz, you mentioned situationists, punk scene. What else might be interesting?
Well, it depends what you mean by my own work. I mean, are you talking particularly about my own writing, or are you talking about the work that I've done with Autonomy Media in terms of publishing for over 20 some years now? And in certain ways, I kind of would say the work of publishing is more important and it has wider effects. But I could sort of talk about how those two levels sort of relate because they share many common influences. The sort of joke version I told about Autonomia is it's kind of like Brooklyn Autonomia, right? So you have some people from the autonomous Marxism who end up in Brooklyn in the late 70s. So you have this sort of overlap of people who are interested in media politics, in Marxism, in aesthetics, and they come together in interesting ways. In terms of how my own work is... Yeah, it's weary that, like, obviously I understand the avant-garde as a important historical category, and I use it actually mainly in a historical sense because, you know, I suppose the cutoff point is sometime in the mid-60s, right, where people get more skeptical of avant-garde parties, and the idea that sort of a meeting form of artistic expression can lead to struggle starts to seem a bit either wrong or silly. And then you get the more people talking about the ideas of activist art, experimental culture, which in some ways takes up a similar role just without the idea of leadership. So it's more of like how to create other ways of being in the world of experimenting with living and doing things together, just without the idea that it's going to lead to struggle.
And this notion of neo-avant-garde, I mentioned this to you when I sent you the topics for our conversation, because I find it troublesome somehow as an Eastern European, because it does not really cover any of the non-Western artists, and it barely covers women in it. It doesn't speak initially the concept of neo-avant-garde, did not mention racialized politics and all the inequalities that came with it, but also all the avant-garde steps that the people of color, you know, took in art and transforming those arts. So I'm curious, like, whether you ever refer to this concept and, you know, what you think about this concept. Do you find it useful?
I don't think I have. Not that I can remember. I mean, I can see for people who are getting, let's say, more traditionally art historical background, well, you have to address these kind of things. But for my sins, that's not my world. I work at a business school. So I get served a different set of problems to deal with rather than that.
Absolutely. That's important for me because not being art historian, I use those interviews for my podcast also to learn about art theory and art history as it is practiced correctly, let's say. So we are both, it seems to me, people who experiment with this theory and with this legacy rather than sort of follow the canonic route. So I'm happy to, you know, find a sort of sisterly relation with you in a sense of like, okay, there are concepts in our history, but perhaps we can theorize and practice those social movements and aesthetic movements differently. Do you have, as leftist scholar, do you have any inclination to save the avant-garde or its legacy? And if so, then like, what do you want to preserve or save?
One thing I do know about, or I personally get as the idea of the avant-garde, is I think, and this is what I'm skeptical about, is the idea that there is nothing, rather than an avant-garde practice being new, it is just sort of merely a sort of reprocessing or repetition of something that came before. And that is a kind of cynicism, which I think is very unhelpful. So for instance, like when Black Mask Up Against the Wall were sort of protesting against Dada exhibitions because they were saying, no, and this is thanks to the New York, because, you know, when they said the true inheritors of Dada are not in the moment, they're like delinquent youth sort of like, you know, causing trouble in the streets. To me, that wasn't a new avant-garde. That was finding the spirit of that sort of political antagonism in a different location than it had been before. Now, in terms of trying to save the avant-garde, I don't know. Probably, honestly, probably not. I mean, I am interested in the saving and recovering of particular histories that have forgotten, which are super interesting. So just staying with Black Mask, I was just reading an interview book with Ben Maria, where he's talking about all the institutions that were built in the Lower East Side in the 60s in terms of mass squatting, community kitchens, and all these things they had produced as part of a sort of a street gang with an analysis, right? So I think there is a certain value to recovering these moments and histories which are oftentimes forgotten. But it's more for recovering and keeping that experience of those memories rather than for saving any particular category or whatever it is.
I right now realized listening to you, that there are two very distinct senses of the avant-garde that I've been actually using without realizing it. One of them is this classical artistic, you know, Malevich, Picasso, Anna Mendieta, I don't know, like artistic, high art sort of endeavors. And then we have the other ones, which is basically squatter culture. And I realized while listening to you that we have this oldest squat in Poland, Rozbrat in Poznan. And when we defended this place from being erased from the map of Poland, one of the arguments that I was particularly focused on was the cultural legacy and the cultural work of that particular squat. It had everything else. It had the social kitchen, you know, tenants movement, squatters movement, Antifa, all the important parts of the classical squatter sort of anarchist activism. But it also was helping artists to exhibit their works and bands, you know, music bands to build their concerts and music and other activity. But especially in the visual arts, Rozbrat played the role that museums refused to play. So whenever an artist was censored, they would come to that place and exhibit their work that was banned elsewhere. And this is an important part, I think, of the work of the avant-garde, is precisely to open ways when censorship comes, when other restrictions come, to basically sort of break through and to find new means and new strategies to sort of contradict those limitations of freedom of speech and expression. And I think this is super important. And I would call many, I agree with you when you are talking about squats as part of the avant-garde legacy. I think this is very much it. It's like, then they often combine also stylistically, aesthetically, new forms of expression, which later become canonized as fashion elements or as artistic elements, etc. So there is, I think, an incredibly productive, also from the perspective of mainstream culture, incredibly productive part of this squatter's legacy. And while, you know, there is this fantastic contradiction that while the mainstream culture looks at squats usually as these weirdos from the, you know, almost demolished houses or something, in the end, the mainstream incorporates very gladly the fashion, the music, the taste in all kinds of ways, and sort of, you know, builds upon this legacy, which otherwise they would see as so antagonistic versus their own, you know, bourgeois or otherwise traditionalist lifestyle. So I'm really happy because it's the first conversation, I think, in which the squatters' cultures sort of emerge as part of the avant-garde. I wonder why it's happened in those conversations. Do you know? But
someone who's really good at this is my friend Alan W. Moore. So the cultural historian, not the comic artist. But he's written several books about the history of the overlap of art and squatting, particularly a book called Occupation Culture, where he's looking at sort of how art and cultural production is very much integral and part of sustaining, because it's the squatting mode, and so. And it's interesting there is the role of art culture production isn't sort of leading or determining the struggle. It's just part of the reproduction of its everyday life, part of structuring its symbolic world. I mean, to give another example, I really liked the ZOD of the occupation in Nantes to stop the airport being built. If you go there, The sort of central info shop has this giant lighthouse type structure that when you look at it, looks like it came out of like a 1920s Russian constructivist piece.
Yeah.
So the people who are part of that world are very much drawing from that legacy, absolutely need to diffuse their role and how they operate in a way that I think is quite interesting.
It is interesting also because, as Boris Groys wrote in his essay, which I found incredibly inspiring from 2010, about the universality of avant-garde, he speaks there of the choices of working with basic colors, basic geometric shapes, as effort from the Russian constructivism to become accessible, to become common, not only in the sense of collectively owned, but also common in the sense, I think, of ordinary or everyday grounded and focused. And I think this is the squatters culture par excellence. I'm thinking now also about Amsterdam and broadly the Dutch squatters scene from the 80s and 90s. I don't know if you know it, but in 1980, 10% of the buildings were squatted in Amsterdam. This is how far that subculture, as it was called, or for me, one of the mainstream cultures at the point, at the era in Amsterdam, went for. So, and I think there is something also about the ease of erasure of the radical cultures that worries me a lot. Because when I think of my own activist past, I'm often tempted also by others, mainly by others, to write it down. But then this egocentricism possibility emerges with me sort of monopolizing those experiences, which are so, you know, so collective and so fractal, I would say, so distributed also. So I'm like, my main fear in doing that kind of history or dem story, actually, it would be, is precisely with monopolizing those experiences. On the other hand, when I speak with people who are just 10 years younger than me and who don't know about what was happening in Warsaw, also in terms of scale, you know, like we had some thousands of people going to wild raves under a bridge in the city, no? And most people have no idea about it. It's like, you know, it doesn't even function as a, as this murmured sort of gossipy knowledge. It was completely erased. So there is this vulnerability of those cultures that makes them disappear so easily. On the other hand, there is also a risk, I think, of monopolizing them or otherwise sort of structuring them in ways that don't give them justice, basically. So I'm curious about your experiences with that, because I believe working with all those fields of art and countercultures, you probably also had been thinking sometimes about those risks. I don't know.
You have moments where you're talking about three random dudes in a gallery by themselves or in a cafe, and then you have moments where something breaks out, becomes very much sort of a mass avant-garde, becomes taken up in a more popular sense. People who are listening to this as a podcast are not going to be able to see it, but for instance, I'm right now I'm wearing a football jersey of FK Vitebsk, which is probably going to get me canceled because it's a team from Belarus. I'm wearing it because it has on it the red wedge design by Eli Lisitsky.
Absolutely. The triangles, yeah, the red and black triangles. Very beautiful, by the way.
So it's just so interesting about how moments where, you know, again, where something that usually is quite marginal, experimental, can be taken up as part of what in the sort of autonomy in the 70s, people talk about mass avant-garde, where it becomes a sort of a popularly shared thing. And it's actually sometimes that moments of shifting into very visible, high visibility are necessarily recognized. Okay, really silly example. People know Woodstock, right? The music festival. The fences were cut by Black Mask. So here you have a moment of turning a sort of pop festival into a sort of coming a sort of mass cultural event that is sort of part of sort of even the sort of most certain black history of the 60s. How that happened is sort of forgotten.
Yeah.
So there's just something about sort of, recovering that.
Mm-hmm. For me, a way of recovering, because I've been working with the archives lately and my major project was about a police operation of surveillance targeting gay men in the 80s in Poland. So from that perspective of this archive, which has not been, I mean, most people thought it was lost. And then I found out that the regional headquarters of Polish police not only have the documents of this operation, but they are still using them, documents from 40 years ago, which are written in a super stereotypical language, very discriminatory, very derogatory sometimes about gay men, you know, and the police is like fueling their own stereotypes by those documents. So I find it absolutely disgusting and dangerous for this institution to have it. And so my strategy of querying the archive moved not totally away from like underground archives of queer cultures, which are incredibly important and I love them and I contributed to them. But also I'm thinking of like transversally bridging between, you know, those little cultures that we and countercultural archives, like queer archives that we want to have, but also about how to introject the knowledge and the artifacts, also the elements of those archives into the mainstream. And I'm thinking that, you know, a good radical strategy, a good avant-garde strategy, if you will, would be also to queer those institutions. So also to ask if there is queer people who want to, I don't know, give their artifacts to the state archives, not police archives per se, but like state archives. And then we would have an image of a gay person, not only from police statistics, you know, police photographies, police documents, etc. But we would have also, I don't know, tango competitions of gay men, photos or some memoirs or some little artifacts, etc. So I'm curious about this kind of romancing with the mainstream culture, you know, what you think about that and whether it by necessity dilutes the countercultural, you know, and avant-garde legacy, or whether it can serve something interesting.
Well, the thing that makes me think about is this is 2014 now, but my friend Gavin Grindin curated an exhibition at the V&A Museum in London, which if people don't know is kind of like the museum of like stuff the empire stole, right? And it was an exhibition called Disobedient Objects, which was a history of sort of almost like the production of material culture in activist movements. So things like mechanisms for people locking onto each other, sort of protest props and stuff. And one of the things I found super interesting about it, in the signage during the exhibition, there was two layers of signage. The one was sort of the typical sort of like layer of signage written by people working for the museum. And the second was sort of a self-narration of the object by the people who made it. And I think that's the interesting thing there, is sort of how these two layers connect or don't connect. Because there are histories of different kinds of archival spaces like Bay Day rooms in London or activist archiving spaces where you get more a recording of this self-narration of what's being produced. But the question is how that intersects with your more typically institutional history.
And also many archives are endangered by human character, basically. So basically quarters within the movements become the end of many archives. I've seen it in Poland with some feminist and lesbian archives and some anarchist archives as well, and I was really sad about that. But the other reason, more popular and more dangerous, is the lack of funding. Basically, archives are protected until the person who is willing to host them or take care of them is ready and able to do it. If not, then those archives disappear. So I really enjoyed getting to know the Amsterdam Gay Archive, which is the Ilia Archive, which is basically a mix of countercultural, underground, and NGO archivizing. They merged with the city library and they became like one floor is basically this queer library, which is being serviced by the people from the LGBTQ and A and plus NGO. So it's like a separate entity, but within the larger public archive. And I think that could be a way, because it's incredibly difficult to get rid of things from the public libraries, as we know. So it's sort of a way of stacking this queer content into the public archive collection for longer than just the lifespan of several activists who are at the moment willing to take care of it. But we will not know how their lives are gonna go. Listen, I'm kind of happy with our conversation and I would like to stop at this point in order to be able to thank you for your input for everything that you have said. And also I'll be happy to record another episode one day where we can focus a little bit more on, let's say, avant-garde and counterpublics, whenever you're ready also with, you know, to talk about that part, because I find it's very exciting. So thank you so very much for being the guest in the podcast and also for all the work that you have done to, maintain the legacy of the countercultures. I'm very touched at the moment. I don't know why.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
I'm trying to finish